Well, thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here this morning. Before I start any of research talks, I am a clinician scientist. I'm a neurosurgeon, and I operate and my research. So first thing I do is I acknowledge my clinical colleagues, because these are the folks that I share bread, and they allow me to spend significant time in the lab. And then members of the Brain Tumor Center, the Mars building over there, we're on the 11th floor. And you've heard some, I think Sheila spoke here the other day, and she did her work over there with Peter. And there's several clinicians and clinician scientists that make up that. And last, of course, lab members and my funders. So quick little primer. I don't know how much Sheila went over in terms of a glioblastoma and brain tumors. But as a general rule, gliomas, which is the subject of this morning's talk, is about 40% of all primary CNS tumors. And if you look at that piece of the pie, and then you look at the different types of glial cells, those arising from the astrocytic lineage, the astrocytomas, is about 3/4. Now, if you further subdivide that into the various grades of astrocytoma as per the WHO classification, as you can see, this large hunk of the pie is the glioblastoma, and this is what we're dealing with, the most common primary adult brain tumor in humans. My comments are going to be adult because the whole realm in pediatric, the molecular biology, the type of tumors they get are totally different. So what do we do if you got a glioblastoma? The state of the art, and I'm going to go over this so I can build up for the rest of the talk, is that we give maximal surgery. So the patient comes to me, if possible, I will try to take out as much as I can see with my eye and through the microscope. And what you can do is probably get about a log kill or so. But you know, there's lots and lots of tumor cells because it's infiltrative that's still remaining. But you do as maximal with the dictum, don't push the envelope to cause paralysis, etc. Okay? It's not worth it. So if you can take it out, keeping the risk low, take out as much as you can. So that's the first thing we do. And so as surgeons, we do some good. Then you give radiation. Okay? And what this trial has shown from 2005 is that if you give radiation plus this drug, this alkylator, temozolomide, that they actually do better if they just got the radiation alone. So this was the first little movement in this survival curve for GBMs, which is the 9 to 12 month survival that has been there for several decades, the first little step forward we had. So now we're looking at about a 15 month or so median survival. 2 years was 26%. But what was more interesting than just that survival. Now, if you look at the molecular characteristics, because this is a alkylator, that if the DNA repair enzyme, MGMT, or AGAT actually, is methylated and the promoter is silenced, and they could not repair the damage caused by the temozolomide, then actually those folks did better than the folks with the unmethylated ones. So right now, what the standard of treatment is that you get this and you look at the methylation status, and the responsiveness can be kind of predicted based on the methylation status. But again, you're bringing it up to 20 months in that subgroup, okay? And all of the things that we're doing right now is based on this standard of therapy, and see whether we can push that survival curve further. And this, of course, is where the role of biologicals are coming in. And we realized, and we've tried biologicals in brain tumors, anti-EGFR and anti-RAS inhibitors, etc. But I think what we're realizing, it's not going to be a single biological agent, and because these tumors are heterogeneous, it's going to be a cocktail of these things attacking it in different ways. I think another area that really requires the integration of physical science and biological science for this particular tumor, we need to develop novel ways of molecularly characterizing this tumor. This tumor, like a lot of other solid tumors, are not static. They're changing, and they're changing with the environment, changing with the growth, changing with the treatment. And if I mean, unfortunately, in the brain, you can't go and do repeated samples. So we really need to have imaging and other methods, biomarkers, where we can perhaps, in a non-invasive manner, follow this moving train and then hit it appropriately over different periods of time. Something in the literature that's, of course, in vogue is the issue of whether the drugs that you throw at it, the bulk of the tumor, is not going to be really going to affect the root of the tumor, the so-called cancer stem cell, or the tumor cell of origin. And it is a very nice hypothesis. It remains to be proven. Certainly in blood tumors, I think it's very well proven, but in solid tumors like brain tumors, it's still a big question mark. But indeed, there may be a subset of cells which requires another kind of regime. Now, whether that's just because they're molecularly different, it's got nothing to do with them being real stem cells or not, those are unanswered questions. And there are different delivery modalities. This is, I think, where the mathematical integration can also occur in some of the ways we can deliver these macromolecule drugs to the brain, because, as you know, there's a blood-brain barrier. And one of the things that we've really, over the last 4 or 5 years or so, is this phenomenon of convection-enhanced delivery, where instead of just diffusion, you give it a slow pump, a small pressure, and there's a wider distribution through those light matter tracts, because the problems with GBMs or these gliomas is not the portion that you see on the MR scan, because I can take that out, or the radio surgery, or someone can burn it out. It's those infiltrating tumor cells. So these modalities of treatment, modeling them, how are we doing in different catheter systems? This is an area of active interest and integration in terms of delivery to the brain. So the bottom line is we've got a long way to go. We've made a little dent with that temozolomide study. It's a little dent. It's still a 15 months or 16 months death sentence if you have one of these tumors. So one victim is that this is a cross-section of a patient with a GBM, and you can see macroscopically it is heterogeneous. Okay, there's areas of hemorrhage and cavitation. There is areas of necrosis, but there are tumor cells right up here, which doesn't look too bad. Okay. And so it is very heterogeneous, and we knew about this long, long time ago. And pathologically, it corresponds. And here is an area of looking at perfusion. There are areas which are perfused here in the blue and hypoxic area. So we know that the microenvironment is different, and that these that there exists within this tumor mass subpopulation of cells. And those subpopulations of cells may differ in their primary genetic alterations, or they also may differ because of epigenetic regulation. Okay, so and that may occur. And we must not forget that it's not just the tumor cell component, because when you take out a GBM or any solid tumor, the tumor cell component is probably about half. The other half of the tumor are the stromal cells, the endothelial cells, the fibroblasts, etc. So if we concentrate all our studies on the tumor cells, we're missing out on the other half. And they're very, very important. And they are also can be regulated each other, of course. And so we must not forget this. So how does this subpopulation occur? Well, you know, one hypothesis is that there's a tumor cell of initiation, or the cancer stem cell. And then you've got differentiated tumor cells. So you've got a bag of marbles, a different kind of marbles. Well, okay, that's a hypothesis. Another one is that there's dedifferentiation. So you've got these tumor cells, but because of their genetic alterations, they have dedifferentiated. So now they express not only markers of an astrocyte, but also a neuron, oligodendrocytes, and other markers. And this happens with cancer, we know that. But so it could be a mixture of that, dedifferentiation and differentiated tumor cells. Or this bag of marbles can be a response to the microenvironment and the macroenvironment, different regions influencing the tumor cells and the stromal cells to have a different molecular phenotype. So I think I put question marks there, because I have not seen anything that, yeah, this is the reason you got the heterogeneity. I think these are all plausible hypotheses. They all have experiments that are in support. They also have experiments which negate them, okay, or are not in support. And it very well may be that it's a mixture of all of these different ways that why we have a bag of marbles instead of just one type. So to look at this in a clinical setting, so in GBM, here's a ring-enhancing lesion, present with a seizure or headaches or whatever, and that's the area that I said that I can take care of as a surgeon. But that white area on the T2 flare here, you can see that's the infiltrating cells. There are tumor cells. That's where the recurrence is going to occur after I take that out, after the radiation, etc. 95% of the time it's around that area. So geographically, the center area consists of necrosis here, pseudopalisading cells where the cells heap up on each other, and hyperproliferation of the blood vessels. And it's this glomerular tufts where the endothelial cells, instead of being one layer, they sort of heap up on each other. And these are glomerular tufts. Now, by no means are these functional vessels. And I think you're aware of Rakesh Jain's work about normalization of tumor vessels. But there's lots of them. They shunt and they bleed. As I showed you in the cross section, these tumors bleed on there. And this is the infiltrating edge. The edge is out here. And there are tumors infiltrating. The vessels are increased, but look normal rather than the glomerular tuft. So at least there's two of these areas just to start off with. So my talk is going to, the first part is going to be on neuropilin and its role in angiogenesis. I think I'll do the Warburg, and I won't have time to look at the inhibitors of apoptosis. So in terms of this heterogeneity, these are the three molecular alterations that we're looking at in my laboratory. Something to do with angiogenesis and invasion, and something to do on apoptosis. So to start off with, I started for this set of projects from the operating room and then went to the lab. Okay? So I've got a bunch of GBM patients, like I showed you here, and here's one, where MR, that's the center, that's the periphery, took biopsies before I did the resection, so I got samples from that area, confirmed them pathologically on paraffin sections, we have frozen sections, and then our team, using laser capture microdissection, cut out the tumor cells from the center and periphery and endothelial cells from center and periphery, and this is just an RT-PCR showing that the endothelial cells have transcripts which are specific to endothelial cells and not tumor cells, while the tumor cells have transcripts such as GFAP and S100, which are specific to tumor cells. So it was a relatively pure population we could extract. So the first hypothesis, first thing that we wanted to look at was an extension of some publication I'd done before, is to look at neuropilin, and this is a protein that is highly secreted by the tumor cells and endothelial cells, and it has a couple of choices. It's a cofactor for VEGF-165, the most soluble kind of VEGF that's secreted, and it can help VEGF-165, neuropilin, that complex, bind to VEGFR2 and therefore promote angiogenesis. The other choice it has, it can hold hands with semaphorins and then activate plexins, and then this would lead to increased invasion. And the question we started off with was the role of neuropilin in the center and periphery sort of varying in terms of angiogenesis or invasion depending on which partner it was piggybacking to. So this is the work that we had published a while ago, essentially characterizing neuropilin at that time. It was not characterized, and we showed that neuropilin expression increased as you went from normal brain to low grade to GBMs, both at the transcript level and at the protein level. And this is just immunohistochemistry showing neuropilin expression both in the tumor cells and in the endothelial cells of GBMs. So to confirm that those isolations that we had done were actually valid for the endothelial cell tumor cells, I showed you an RT-PCR of that. One of the first things we did was real-time PCR because we knew that the center would have increased levels of VEGF because, of course, of this hypoxic stimulation, and the centers are relatively hypoxic. And indeed, VEGF is increased in the center as well as its receptor. So that was just confirmation of the quality of the tissue. So we then went on to look at neuropilin and its other partners involved in invasion, Semaphore and 3A, and Plexin. And indeed, what we found that the inverse was true, that there was increased expression of these molecules in the periphery versus the center. And this is the real-time PCR data, and this is the immunohistochemical data, corresponding data from the same sections formed. So to look at the functional significance of neuropilin, we used siRNA technology. And so before that, we took the characterized a human GBM cell line, high expressions of neuropilin and plexins, and HUVEX expressing neuropilin. And and this is the real-time PCR data of that. We decreased neuropilin with siRNA. Here's the couple of siRNAs. Here's the control siRNA, both in the GBM cell lines as well as the endothelial cells. And this is just flow confirmation of that data. And when you did that, the glioma cell lines in invasion assay and in migration assay did not invade and migrate to the same extent. When you did that with the siRNA, and these are the various controls, control siRNA. However, it had very little effect on proliferation. It was not altering proliferation. When we looked at the endothelial cell compartment, where we had also altered neuropilin, what we found was that there was decreased tubular formation and decreased branching formation with decrease in neuropilin. Some of the mechanisms we've delved into is that we think that a lot of the secondary effects of neuropilin downregulating invasion is effects on metalloproteases. Specifically, we found that MMP2 was decreased, not MMP9, and this is the zymography confirming the results that we found up here on real-time CT. We also found effects on integrins, especially alpha beta 3. I think you're going to be talking about some of this stuff, yeah. And we found that decreasing neuropilin also decreased integrin expression, and this was actually increased further if you blocked with a plexin antibody. So this portion of the talk, to very quickly summarize, the data suggests that neuropilin has two kinds of roles. Okay, in the center, where there's lots of VEGF, as I showed you before, and I didn't talk about these two molecules, angiopoietins, but these are another area of study, it can hold hands with VEGF 165 to stimulate VEGF receptor 2 and stimulate this high glomerular tufts that you see in the center, the characteristics. While it has less of a role in interacting with SEM3A and plexins, and there's decreased migration, so the cells are not migrating, they're hyperproliferating, giving to this pseudopalisading that you see around the necrotic area, this increased number of proliferating cells around this necrotic area. While in the periphery, our model is highly suggestive that the levels of SEM3A and plexins, as I showed you, is higher, and the VEGF is lower. And here, the role of neuropilin is to act as a cofactor to SEM3A and promote invasion. So a same molecule in a different kind of a tumor environment may have different kind of biological activity. And so this is something that we're following up with some pharmacological alterations. We have some transgenic models in the necrosis, and we're trying to see whether we can alter the pathological phenotype. So the second part that I was going to cover, I think I've got 10 minutes. The second part was the heterogeneity and regulators of apoptosis. And there's two parts to this. This is how tumor cells utilize glucose, the Warburg effect that I will talk about. And this work, I won't have time probably, is the inhibitors of apoptosis. And Bill Joy is the postdoc doing that, and she's an MD, and Perro is an MD PhD student working on the Warburg effect. And this again starts from the clinic and asking the question. I showed you the center and the periphery, then we did tunnel stains, and you know, the rate of apoptosis between the center, where it's a relatively harsher environment, hypoxic environment, is not actually any higher than the periphery. And the question is, why aren't those tumor cells dying? And why are they resistant to therapy? Okay. And I showed you the pseudopalisading cells. So why aren't they dying? So one of the questions or potential answers is how tumor cells alter their metabolism. And we're going to focus here on glucose metabolism. And like a lot of things, it was mentioned years ago, and we're really now getting excited about it. And this was mentioned by Warburg. And basically what he says is that unlike normal cells who undergo oxidative phosphorylation, the generation of 36 ATP, tumor cells, due to alterations in their metabolic molecular phenotype, various enzymes, produce lactate, which promotes invasion, 2-ATP, and there are a variety of other anabolic intermediates which are present for allowing the tumor cells to keep on proliferating at a fast rate. So we have started to look at hexose kinase 2, and there are several reasons. First of all, it's one of the first steps in the glucose metabolism, and there is some linkage with cancer. And this whole area of metabolism really has taken off, and this is just a couple of papers back to back from earlier this year in Nature from Lou Cantley's group, which looked at another enzyme, pyruvate kinase, and basically showed that in cancer cells, the fetal isoform reappeared. And the fetal isoform was more resistant to aerobic glycolysis and promoted the anaerobic glycolysis with the 2-ATP, and that this was growth advantageous. And it makes sense that cancer cells are adapting their metabolism and growing fast and surviving. So, and there's linkage between a lot of the major pathways we think are important in cancer, such as HIF-1 alpha, a lot of the oncogenic stimuli, like mediated through RAS, SARC, etc., and these enzymes, hexose kinase, for example, here, that are linked in glucose and lipid and nucleic acid metabolism. Our studies are just on glucose metabolism. So hexose kinase 2, there's a lot of it in the cytoplasm, but when activation of signaling pathways, AKT, RAS, these are major signaling pathways that we think are aberrant in GBM, one of the things it does, it results in translocation from the cytoplasm or the inner cell membrane to the mitochondrial membrane. And it blocks these VDAC, voltage-dependent anion channels, and it prevents release of a variety of cytochromes and caspases to allow apoptosis. So activation, oncogenic activation, results in hexose kinase 2 translocation, blockage of the mitochondria, blockage of release of cytochrome C, and inhibition of apoptotic pathways. So this was some of the stuff that we got from the literature. And then you start to look at our GBM. So first thing you note, we again went back to that center and periphery. Hexose kinase 2 is highly upregulated in the center. Hexose kinase 1 was not versus the periphery. This is the area of the hypoxia, the cells that are surviving with a unexpected lower apoptotic rate, and this is the immunohistochemistry confirmation of that. So we started to look at some cell lines, both in a P53 plus and a P53 mutant background, and if you knock down hexose kinase 2, then you decrease cell viability here in both these cell lines. And this was actually more pronounced under hypoxic conditions. So if hypoxia or other stressors that I'll show you was introduced and you had blocked that hexose kinase 2, so prevented the anaerobic glycolysis, the Warburg effect, then you would promote apoptosis. And this is other measures of apoptosis using an X and tunnel staining. So that was out of state. Okay. So now the question is the mechanisms. We wanted to see whether indeed that there was translocation. So we have hexose kinase 2 knockdown cells and with scrambled siRNA. And as you can see under hypoxic stress, there's a shift to the mitochondrial membrane. And this shift is abrogated with knockdown of hexose kinase. And this is a mitochondrial dye, and basically the permeability. And if you just have the glioma cell lines in hypoxic condition, it's not permeable. But if you blocked hexose kinase 2 and prevented that translocation here, then there was permeability of the mitochondrial membrane. This resulted in cytochrome C release under hypoxic conditions into the cytoplasm of these glioma cell lines, resulting in the apoptosis. And also, this is a soft agar assay, decreased growth in soft agar. So the mechanism of survival in pseudopalisading cells, why are those cells living? I think is part of it is due to the environment switching the way the cancer cells use glucose. And also, as I say, it affects lipids and nucleic acid metabolism. We believe, and I haven't shown you all of the data, we have the animal data now, that's part of this is due to alterations in hexose kinase 2 expression. It's elevated in these GBMs. And inhibition of hexose kinase 2, it's an enzyme, so there are small molecule inhibitors now that are coming on board, may be able to augment the sensitivity to radiation or chemotherapy so that resistant population of cells may also undergo apoptosis. So I will not talk about IAPS because I think my time is done. But essentially, the other bit of this project of why these cells are not dying is to look at these molecules of proteins, which are called inhibitors of apoptosis, and there's a whole family of these proteins, and these block both the intrinsic and extrinsic apoptosis pathway. Our findings essentially suggest that there's differential expression in the center and periphery, and if you can manipulate these IAPs, then you can also favorably push the tumor cells to become more sensitive to apoptotic inducers such as radiation. So I think I'm going to finish there. That's okay in that time. And so in conclusion is that there is tumor heterogeneity. There is different types of cells. It's at a macroscopic level. It's also at a molecular level. A lot of these may be due to primary genetic alteration, a subset of cells with a primary mutation in EGF receptor. It's more prone to be able to survive in a certain areas. But a lot of it is also epigenetic and is influenced by the microenvironment, the hypoxia, and the oxygenations and the lactic acids in terms of altering the genetic phenotype. And I think in GBMs and in a lot of cancers where our goals are is how do we keep up with a being which is altering, which is changing its shape. And it changes the shape as we throw various therapies because it is trying to adapt and survive. And how can we, non-invasively keep abreast of that and then throw at it things which are appropriate to that alterations and maybe even in different regions. So I'll finish there. Thank you very much.